These are the Get Over Yourself podcast sponsors. Mofo, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone naturally. Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, a mind-blowing nut butter blend. Carol Fit, stationary bike, awesome 8-minute workout. Organifi, whole food organic superfood supplements and drink blends. Perfect Keto, the cleanest, highest potency ketone supplements. Viori Clothing, fashionable, functionable, incredibly comfortable performance apparel. And please visit the bradkearns.com shop page for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance. And here we go with the show.
We're talking about people who are going to go into combat with, you know, with their brothers in arms to their right and their left. And the number one goal is not that they're fit. The number one goal is to make sure that this is a person who, with his dying breath, will do everything to accomplish the mission. I never won anything, but I was always in the top finishers of all of those. I never failed a single physical event in all of Bud's, but I also never won one of them. The only superpower I have is superhuman will, right? I just have, and many SEALs do, and many successful people do. It's not necessarily the physical talents or the mental talents or whatever it is, it's just superhuman will.
Hey, listeners, you're going to love this amazing journey of Eric Frohart, former Navy SEAL. We are going to go backstage into the world of basic training and trying to make it through that amazingly difficult funnel to graduate the Navy SEAL Buds training and become a member of the SEAL teams. Eric did it for 12 years, going all over the world, applying amazing and disparate skills. He was a sniper. He was the lead mountain climber. He was a demolition expert. Oh my gosh. But just getting started from a small town experience in Iowa, he went off to college. He formulated a dream one day that he wanted to be a Navy SEAL. He wanted to prove people wrong that told him he couldn't do it. Imagine those people saying you can't make it to become a Navy SEAL. And so off he went. And you're going to pick up a recurring theme in his story, which was a total lack of experience or preparation to take on these phenomenal challenges. And he just went out there and did them. The first time he saw the ocean was at Navy SEAL training. He climbed the highest mountains in North America and South America with no mountaineering preparation, did a little trip up El Capitan, the most impressive wall on earth, with very little preparation. And he did it with this incredibly resolute and positive mindset. Listen carefully during the recording to his speech patterns and how he closes the loop on these comments, like it was just going to happen. We were just going to get it done, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great show. We just simply have a conversation about what it's like to go for these dreams and achieve them and try to leverage those skills into real life. Interestingly, towards the end, he talks about how it is a difficult transition to come out of that intense military experience into real life, but the importance of leveraging those skills and that mindset that he developed into his various entrepreneurial efforts that he's been making in recent years. So please enjoy this interesting conversation. You're going to be wowed. You're going to be pumped up. And here we go with Eric Frohart. I have Eric Frohart coming to me from his new home. Exciting. Or en route to your new home, Omaha, Nebraska. So we come to the heartland to bring you this show, listeners. And it is going to be a wild one. We've warmed up for just a few minutes and I've already heard some amazing discussion points that we're going to get into. But oh man, thanks for joining us, Eric.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here. It's been fun listening to a few of your episodes recently. Very cool.
Well, your background is extremely interesting. You're still a young guy and you got a long life ahead of you, but oh my gosh, what a journey, particularly the experience as a Navy SEAL. But yeah. I want to get right into that, especially those quick transitions that you mentioned about how you jumped into this. You'd never seen the ocean when you went off to SEAL training. So tell us kind of, you know, your background and how you got into that extremely intense career.
Sure. Well, you know, my wife and I joke about this regularly. I just turned 42. We're both 42. We've been married for nearly 18 years. We have four kids, essentially ages 8 to 15. We've lived in San Diego, Virginia, Denver, and now Omaha. And I think, you know, I've done 7 combat deployments. So in 42 years, we've crammed a lot into it so far. And really probably the most, you know, one of the more interesting things for me, the most rewarding thing, you know, being married and having kids, it's been really a huge blessing. But, you know, a lot of people are more interested in my time in the SEAL teams. And I had, so I was in college for 1 year and, I was playing football, and I kind of realized after one season of football that the good Lord had not, you know, made me for that, not quite big, fast, or strong enough, for it. And then, literally was watching a movie in a dorm room one night in college, my freshman year. And there was something about the Navy SEALs came on, and, you know, I stood up and said, "Hey, I'm going to leave college and become a Navy SEAL." And someone was like, "You'll never make it, right? It's too hard. And you're not big, fast, or strong enough," or whatever. And I bet them, and I joined the Navy the next day, you know, on a bet that I couldn't become a Navy SEAL. And who would have thought that would end up with me doing that for nearly 12 years before I got hurt and the Navy decided I couldn't do it anymore. So I enlisted in the Navy on a bet. I finished that year of college and joined the Navy that next day, and I was on the delayed entry, and I shipped out, you know, before, you know, that basically that coming fall, and went on to do 12 years. Like you said, I'd mentioned in our intro that I never seen the ocean, never saw the ocean before, you know, literally before SEAL training. And my thought was, my only real experience, or I guess my perception of the ocean, was based on the show Baywatch. So I'm like, "Oh, it's like, it's sunny and it looks pretty warm, and how hard can it be?" And as you know, the Pacific Ocean is not so warm. And cold water is what makes most people quit SEAL training. So that, you know, that was kind of an eye opener. I think I told you it was the third time, but as I reflect, it may have been the fourth time that I got on an airplane in my life. I was wearing a parachute. So I'd never taken a flight anywhere. I'd never, until I joined the Navy. And then I took a flight to boot camp, a flight to another school, a flight to jump school, which was in Fort Benning, Georgia. So that's 3. And then the fourth time I got on an airplane, I was wearing a parachute. So you have this, you know, a kid from a cornfield in Iowa who enlisted in the Navy on a bet, who's never seen the ocean, dumb enough to raise my hand when they ask who's never seen the ocean. I raised my hand, and they went and surf tortured me for like long enough to give me hypothermia. So, I guess I'm kind of rambling, but it was a steep learning curve.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, a lot of kids are out there watching the Navy commercials. The recruiters are cruising around the high school campus everywhere you look. But that journey from deciding to enlist and then getting to SEAL training, I imagine there's some way to distinguish yourself really quickly. So how did that go from the time you enlisted? And also, did you inform your football coaches that you were dumping them for the Navy SEALs?
Yeah. So I did tell my coach, and I wasn't that great in college football. I was really good in high school, but I played in small town, right? So big fish, small pond situation. I had met in the spring. We have spring football, and I met with my college football coach, and they're like, "Hey, we're gonna, you know, we'll offer you a little scholarship this year." I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I'm gonna join the Navy and become a SEAL." Of course, that was, he was like, "Whatever, you'll never make it." and you know, I mean, part of it was, you know, a chip on my shoulder. I'm gonna prove them wrong. Really, that's probably most of it, and. You know, I was not really sure what I was going to do. And I, you know, that was the first time I was certain that I wanted to do something. And then when I joined, it was pre-9/11, so it would have been 1998. And there was not the wealth of knowledge that we have now from all the books and the websites and things like that. So, you know, I got a little pamphlet from my recruiter and, proceeded to, you know, run a lot on the gravel roads. And, you know, I didn't really have a gym, so I'd do push-ups in the barn. And then I did, you know, kind of Rocky style. I didn't have a pull-up bar. I just did tons of pull-ups on the rafters in the barn. And, you know, it all worked out. Our buds class started with around 190 people, 187.
This is the budding SEAL members. So they have to go through.
It's selection to become a SEAL. So it's BUDS, which stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. And you're not a SEAL when you finish it, but it is the hardest part of becoming a SEAL.
So how do you become one of those 190 out of thousands of enlists?
Good. Nowadays, when you do that, you can have that, you can have a guarantee to become one of those 190 if you pass certain tests prior to joining. I didn't even have that. I had to take a test in boot camp. And if I passed that test in boot camp, I could be one of those who showed up to try out. And sure enough, I was. So,
was it a pretty rigorous test, physical challenges or,
you know,
multiple choice questions? Are you sure you want to do this? True or false? That kind of thing.
The test then, and I'm not sure what it is now. It's not really that hard. You had to be able to do, you know, like 11 pull-ups and 50 push-ups. And it wasn't that hard. You had a 1.5 mile run and some other, you know, a swim test, some sit-ups. It was not representative of the fitness that would be required of you, you know, to make it through BUDS training. Like in BUDS training, you are the thing that hurts people the most is the running. And, you know, outside of your normal workouts, your body weight calisthenics, your log PT, your O course, your 2 mile ocean swims, or your weekly timed runs, every day you are running to and from chow 3 times a day, 1 mile each way. So you get six miles of running without working out just to eat. And that leads to a lot of lower extremity, you know, overuse, you know, kind of like stress fractures below the knee, right? So you have to kind of work into it. So you do have to put the miles in running wise. But, you know, you have to eventually be able to do at least 20 pull-ups, 120, you know, sit-ups, 120 push-ups in a row, you know, running a 4 mile run, you know, in soft sand in like 27 minutes. I forgot what the time is on the ocean swim, which is, you know, there's no line on the bottom of the ocean to kind of follow. So you're kind of zigzagging everywhere. So it was, you know, it was definitely not, wasn't quite what I expected.
So you get out there to BUDS training and the attrition rate is extremely high. Do you have figures on that for how many of that 187 completed?
So in our, I think I think statistically it's anywhere from 20 to 25% make it through. And they, I think that number, obviously there's some fluctuation. I think that's the statistic average. And, you know, the Navy has spent millions of dollars trying to understand what makes someone more likely to make it through. Wow. And what, and whether it's psychology testing or, you know, different fitness tests, and they've determined they can't figure it out. And,
oh, but Richard Gere solved that question decades ago.
Right.
He said he had no other place to go.
Yeah.
That was brilliant. Yeah.
They can't, you know, they can't, you can't measure heart, right?
So they really have spent a lot of time and energy doing, obviously, the physical challenges. You need someone who's not overweight and lazy, but it seems like they could lock into some personality profiles and check you out for an hour when you show up in Coronado.
There are some personality profiles, you know, as part of your selection and your training. And then the longer you stay in, the more kind of, you know, you do have personality profiling and things like that for different assignments. But, you know, I don't know why, but it's really whether people lie on tests or whatever. You cannot measure toughness on a piece of paper. Our class started that 190, you know, about 190 people or 187. And 6 months later, there were 19 of us left who made it through. So almost, you know, right at the 10% mark, we had 22 that total graduated, and only 19 of them were from that original 190 that started. So we had a couple of rollbacks, and it just, you know, it's just hard.
Wow. That's fascinating, because if you could kind of bottle up those character attributes, it would apply to the business world, to hiring and firing and all that wonderful stuff, because certainly the physical challenges are the things people fixate on. But I know from talking to, you know, guys that didn't make it through and whatnot, it kind of goes beyond how strong of an ocean swimmer you are.
Absolutely. If you took a group photo of 190 or who, you know, of us that started, and you said, all right, take your shirts off, we're going to circle the, you know, on this photo, that, you know, the 10 or 20% that is going to make it through training, you'd get some right, you'd get some wrong. Like some of them looked like they were going to make it, you know, they're ripped, and others you would have never guessed. Right. And if you're,
jeez, man, maybe you should have stayed with football. You would have been like Julian Edelman, you know, 5'10", 182, catching passes in the Super Bowl and getting open past these, you know, athletic freaks that are trying to guard him. Incredible. Right.
Maybe make a little more money and get blown up a few less times. So.
Wow. So in your personal experience, I mean, what do you think was your winning formula? I'm sure that after a while, you didn't care about the guy in the dorm and the $50 or the $100, nor the football coach who told you wouldn't make it. Because I think those are, we call those extrinsic motivators, right? And the psychologists validate that those are not as powerful as someone who's motivated intrinsically. And you called it heart or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I think there's a couple of different factors, you know, one of them being, you know, I'm the oldest of four, but I've always been A-type and driven. And but my two little brothers are like significantly bigger than me. So that might have given me a chip on my shoulder. I'm also, when I decided to join you know, the Navy, most people said I couldn't do it. And then my dad was like, oh, you can do that and you would be great at it.
Wow. So that's a perfect blend, you know. You got the naysayers. It's like Rocky, you know, all the naysayers, but then the guy in his corner saying, you know, hit him in the ribs, Rock.
Yep. And then
you need a guy in your corner, man. I love it. Thanks, Dad.
It was very powerful when I told him, and he's like, oh, I think you could do that. I think you do a great job at it. And then also, you know, I'm from a small town, a very small town, and most of the people there are, you know, there's people from all shapes and sizes and from all around, you know, the U.S. But, you know, I graduated high school with about 30 people, and, you know, my parents still live in a very small town. And unlike people from a large town, I didn't have any anonymity. So if you're from New York City or LA and whatever, and you don't make it, like your family will know about it. A couple of friends will know about it, but no one else will know. My town would have known. And we're a close family, but that town is small too. When I graduated Hell Week, there was like a sign on the, it was written on the bank sign that I had made it through Hell Week. So there was also some healthy, you know, small towns are not all bad, right? There's some good and some bad with it, but there's no part of it was I could not, there was no way I was going to go back, you know, with my tail between my legs, having not made it, if that makes sense.
Wow, that's heavy, man. I've never really thought about it that way. Yeah. And a lot of times we think the small town is this isolating experience, a slight disadvantage when you head off to the big university. But this is pretty strong. I interviewed someone on the podcast named Amanda Renteria. She was a candidate for the governor of California. And she told her story of coming from a small farming town, daughter of first generation Mexican immigrant farm workers. And she went off to Stanford, and, you know, she was going to succeed no matter what, because they had, you know, so many hopes and kind of, you know, respect riding on someone who actually made it out and went off to this mythical place called Stanford. And it was, you know, you think about that compared to, you know, the kid whose parents wrote a check to the new biology building so they could get their kid in, and everything was privileged and entitled. And boy, now we're talking about intrinsic motivation. You know, you had your carrying your town on your shoulders.
It was that. I mean, there was definitely a piece of that. There was a piece of the, you know, my family, my town, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. I was not going to. You know, I literally passed a kidney stone in Hell Week, which are like two of kind of the hardest things I can think of. Hell Week's pretty hard.
You got it out of the way during Hell Week instead of on vacation. Right. It would have ruined your vacation, but hey, why not? Let's just do it in Hell Week.
And I didn't know what it was. I was, you know, the Navy diagnosed it as IBS, right?
Like, oh, whatever. My goodness.
Oh, you just have IBS. Here, take this, whatever. And I'm, you know, Hell Week is essentially, it's 5 days nonstop. You get a couple of 15 or 20 minute naps. You're hallucinating and you're walking and running everywhere. And you just can't, it's nonstop. And on about Wednesday afternoon, I started to get some pain in my flank, and, you know, found out later it was, then I was a kidney stone. Anyway, I was either, you know, maybe I wasn't smart enough to quit. Maybe I should have, but I was not going to.
I'm sure everyone's saying, oh, wait till you get to Hell Week. It's super painful. You'll be doubled over in pain. And there's Eric trying to pass a kidney stone thinking it's normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of Hell Week, as if it's not hard enough, you go and you get a medical check at the doctor, and it's not a full week, it's only 5 days, but they call it Hell Week. And on Friday afternoon, after they check you out at the doctor, before you go back to your barracks room, and then you sleep until like Saturday afternoon to get caught up, and they tell you, don't leave base, your immune system is jacked up, you know, we have to monitor you for the next 24 hours and make sure you're okay because of edema and all sorts of, you know, other issues. And I'm sitting there, and so you're wet all week in Hell Week, and I was kind of between sizes on boots, And they recommend getting a smaller boot size because your feet are going to be wet all week. And if you get too big of a boot, you know, you're going to get a blister. So I'm in a boot and I don't get a blister, but my big toenails hurt and they pull my boots off. They had to remove both of my big toenails the day Hell Week got over. And so there I am walking back to the barracks with my new boots in my hands, walking barefoot on the asphalt with my toenails removed. And I'm like, is this, I mean, I was just laughing at how absurd that is, right? It's just hard.
Oh, mercy. You're like the Daniel Craig in the James Bond movie where he's laughing while they're torturing him because he's not going to let him get the better of him.
Right.
So in your experience, did you have some occasions of soul searching? I mean, they're trying to break you. And I wonder, you know, did you come close to that? Or what is the mindset like of a person who succeeds through there? Is there just zero doubt? You don't allow yourself any backup plan?
Yeah, I burnt the boat when I landed on the shore and I was going to make it or they were going to, the only way I wasn't going to make it was, and this happens a lot, like people I would say who would, you know, would have been a better SEAL than I was just didn't make it through because they got hurt. So right. there's plenty.
David Goggins talks about that, right?
Yeah.
He had his stress fractures and that's it.
There's plenty of luck involved, like, you know, not getting hurt. And there's a few acute injuries, like falling off of something on the obstacle course or, you know, some acute injuries, but most of the injuries are just overuse injuries. So and people kind of get rolled back or whatever the case may be. So really that was how I was going to go out. Was if I got hurt, because quitting was certainly not an option. And it never entered my mind. So
oof.
I don't.
Now, would you say that your 19 fellow graduates, do you think they all had that exact mindset?
I think most of them would have. I can't speak to that for sure, but I believe that to be true. I think that at least most of them, and maybe a couple of them got close and they didn't, you know, they didn't quit. But the thing about that is SEAL training is hard and it takes forever, you know, 6+ months to make it through. And then you make it onto a team and there are, you know, everyone, there's an expression, everyone wants to be a SEAL on Friday night at the bar, but no one wants to be a SEAL, you know, Tuesday night when, you know, you're doing training that's cold, wet, tired, and makes you hungry and all that sort of thing, right? Like there are days, whether it's training or combat, where you're going to be as cold or more cold, as tired or more tired than you were in SEAL training. So that's why they make it so hard. They just want people that, you know, don't know how to quit.
You mentioned the cold water is kind of the leading the leading cause of dropping out.
The leading offender.
So what do we need to learn the Wim Hof techniques immediately to, I mean, why is that the thing that gets people? And I guess if you're going to get hypothermic, do you feel like there is some mindset factors that can help you there?
I think so. I mean, I think there's some mindset training, going, kind of just going somewhere else in your head, maybe thinking about good things or trying not to think about warm things because that makes it worse.
Really?
But
interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I know there's some efficacy with, you know, the Wim Hof training and resistance to the cold. I think that would probably help. I'm not sure. I think they would get you. I mean, they'll get you to the point where you will have hypothermia anyway.
So you'll be like, hold on. I got 2 more minutes of my breathing drills before I can enter the ocean, sir. Can you please wait? Oh, I can't go in yet. I'm not done with my sequences.
And one thing that was, that helped me out, I wasn't the best runner. I wasn't the best swimmer. I couldn't do the most push-ups or the most pull-ups, and I couldn't do the obstacle course the fastest. But on all of those things, I was in the top 5 to 10%. So I never won anything, but I was always in the top finishers of all of those. So very much a generalist. And there were people who were amazing runners who were just too skinny or whatever, couldn't do the pull-ups, right? Or the push-ups. And then there would be great swimmers who might not be as good at running, or a gymnast style body, a smaller guy who was super ripped, who could just zoom through the obstacle course, but couldn't run as efficiently because they're shorter, or couldn't swim and maybe they're too dense and they sunk, right? So it really helped me. I never failed a single physical event in all of Bud's, but I also never won one of them. And that made a big difference.
Oh my gosh, you're telling the exact description of a successful triathlete competitor, especially when we get to the level of the pro circuit, where if you are outstanding in a single event, by definition, it means that you're weak in another one because you're racing at the world-class level. And so you had to manage all those things in such that you would have no weaknesses, to the extent that I came into triathlon as a runner in college and high school. So I was that skinny runner guy that could run circles around the track. And right. I'm all of a sudden towing the line with all American NCAA swimmers with that physique and their whole background. And so I had to get worse and worse in running because I had to train my brains out in swimming. But then once you adapt to, in my case, all three, you had a little more than just swimming, biking, and running straight ahead. But that's a great insight, is you by definition have to work those weaknesses so that you can be strong in everything. And I guess imagine someone who's really weak in a certain area, it's going to be so exhausting, fatiguing for them to get through the pull-ups that they're going to suffer on the other seven events.
Right. And, swimming to me, like, was, I tend to sink a little bit, negative. It was all about kind of relaxing and learning how to kind of plane out, I had the Total Immersion book and like tried to practice some of that. It's more of a skill. Like for me, I've always been a good runner, certainly not world-class, but running was something I could do well. But swimming was one of those things where if you tried harder, you didn't necessarily do better.
Oh, mercy. It's so technique dependent that, in coaching recreational triathletes for many years, there comes a point where if your technique is not efficient, you probably shouldn't even practice because you're refining poor technique and making it harder and harder to break through. You should probably just stay home and watch Total Immersion videos.
Yep.
So you're saying you got the Total Immersion book. I'm curious. I imagine the SEAL training is much more sophisticated than you might go and see the boot camp where the kids are coming out of high school and trying to get them in shape. But is it still kind of a few steps back from, the highest level of athletic performance that you'd find in the Olympic Training Center? Because I don't like the idea of taking fit, motivated individuals and giving them stress fractures. That seems ridiculous because you're right. Losing out on superior talent just sure. Because you're overtraining them.
Well, and I think, they have to, there's a different goal when it comes to SEAL training selection. And the goal is, we're talking about people who are going to go into combat with, with their brothers in arms to their right and their left. And the number one goal is not that they're fit. The number one goal is to make sure that this is a person who, with his dying breath, will do everything to accomplish the mission. And so the goal of the Olympic Training Center is to create super athletes. And if I was going to get someone in shape, I wouldn't, I wouldn't send them to Bud's training. There are better. you're gonna leave a little worse off, right? You might.
Oh, mercy! Fit,
but the goal is not that. Like after Buds, you take some time off, you change your training completely in how you want to prepare for a combat deployment, right? Uh-huh. Especially nowadays, because a combat deployment, you might be wearing body armor. You're doing these long, you know, hikes maybe. It's not important to be able to do a run, swim, run type thing. But the goal of Buds training is not to get them fit. It's 100%, you know, to make sure that that guy to your right and left would rather die than quit.
Okay, so there, now you lost me. So far in our interview here, I'm dreaming of myself back in my triathlon day where I could swim 2 miles every morning, no problem, and probably right. beat everybody there. I could do the obstacle course. I could do the running. But if my shin hurts, man, I'm going to be crying in the office. I can't yeah. run anymore. I have a touch spot. It's a hot spot. I need a bone scan.
and if you're training for an athletic goal, like those are the days, like, you know, I look at my heart rate variability. Oh, I'm a little bit sore. Like, I subscribe to your method of training now.
Right.
I am you can imagine a SEAL, and many of us are probably really good at overdoing it. I believe most of the injuries I have come from not just acute things, but just from me hurting myself in a gym.
Right.
So and my goals have changed. Like, now I'm 42. My goal now is when I'm 50, like some of the things you mentioned, can I run a 1 minute, you know, lap around a track, or a 8 minute mile, or do 50 pushups, things like that. With new goals, I'm kind of looking at my heart rate variability, checking how I feel, and really not pushing it as hard, or doing like a sprint day and then a slow day, or a heavy kettlebell mm-hmm. day, and then a relaxing day. So it's a different, now it's different.
Hey, you've been there and done that, man. You're allowed to take care of your body now.
Yes.
Great insight. Hey, I wonder if they've ever done like a stunt or something where, you know, a guy like Ashton Eaton comes to town and is put through the program. You know, he's the world record Olympic decathlete. I mean,
right.
If you had a physical marvel there who was just showing that everything was doable or something like that.
We had, it wasn't my class, it was the class before mine. And they had an Olympic decathlete. He was an alternate for the Olympic decathlon. And he was, you know, up through first phase, he had the fastest swim time, the fastest run time. He could do the most push-ups, pull-ups, and sit-ups. There were things on the obstacle course that, you know, us mere mortals could take us 60 to 90 seconds to go through. And he could almost hurdle them, right? Because he was a mutant. And there were people like that. And ultimately, on the physical things, they always won, but the instructors will break you. And the more gifted you are, the less likely you've been broken or you've failed in your life to that point. And they don't handle it as well.
Wow.
So, and or it's been, things have come a little easier to them. And after about the second hour in the co-op, they're like, really worth it. So you have to want to do it, to endure all of that. Because no matter how fit you are, if you were the most fit person in the world, whatever you use to measure that, and you could do, I don't know, 100 push-ups or 100 pull-ups in a row, they would make you do 120.
Right.
They're just going to push you past that point. And it just becomes, you know, you will break. It's just a matter of how can you deal with it. So.
Oh my gosh. I just heard Tom Brady talking about, you know, how does this guy make it 23 years in the NFL? He was the 197th pick in the draft the year he was drafted. Right. When he got to, you know, he was underdog in high school. He didn't start till his senior year. And he said that at every level, he was obligated to compete because he wasn't that superstar from day one, which most of the guys in the NFL, most of the guys at Division One, they never had to struggle. They never had to worry about the backup, you know, beating them out and all that kind of thing. And he was that guy that had to compete every single level. And that's what it, you know, he attributes as part of his longevity and success formula, that he wasn't afraid to compete. And he was constantly in that position rather than the golden boy. Obviously, you know, in recent years, he's run the team.
Right.
But, you know, to get to that point where he's probably still not taking it for granted, obviously, because he's training his body at a higher level and all that great stuff.
Yeah, I think there's some definite truth to that. I mean, I don't begrudge people who are talented. I mean, I'm sometimes jealous of that. But if you're, you know, if you didn't have that struggle at some point, eventually you're going to, and it helped, you know, the more that you've overcome, the better. It's almost like that is a skill that you can learn to overcome things.
Right. Yeah. And I remember I've written about this before, because you talk about natural talent so much in sports and in triathlon. One of these guys, Mike Pigg, who was one of the greatest of all time at Olympic distance, probably the best ever. And if you look at him and his background, he wasn't naturally talented in any of the sports. He was a mid-level runner from a small town competing against, you know, Division One guys who had evolved over to triathlete. But what I identified in training with him was he had an incredible talent for getting up every day and getting out the door without his brain or his you know, human frailties getting in the way. He was just talented because he could go all day, wake up the next day, and recovery is a talent too. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was an off the charts talent, just like the guy who picks up a bike and 3 months later he can win a time trial. So there's different forms of talent. And I think that whatever you just described, that mental talent, that, you know, resiliency is definitely something that, hey, maybe you were born with it, just like the guy who was born with size 14 flipper feet like Michael Phelps, you know?
Right. A buddy of mine said the other day, and I wrote it down and I put it into my Evernote because it really hit home with me. You know, the only superpower I have is superhuman will. I have nothing, like no other. I mean, I'm in shape now, and there's certain things I can do maybe that others can't, but that's just from hard work, right? I just have, and many SEALs do, and many successful people do. It's not necessarily the physical talents or the mental talents or whatever it is. It's just superhuman will.
So the superhuman will took you to a 12-year career, which seems like kind of a long time to be an active SEAL. I don't know what the average is, but you're out there, man, getting deployed left and right. Tell us what the career is like with the deployments, and then you go back to training or you have time off. I'm also wondering, like, you did all that hard work. You made it through Bud's training. Everyone wants to be a SEAL. Besides the cred at the bar on Friday night, do you have other benefits in terms of your military career? I don't know. Do the SEALs get paid more, or, you know, why do people want to suffer so bad if all you got is a tagline on Friday night?
Sure. No, that could be a whole episode, but I did 12 years roughly. I would have done 20 had I not gotten medically retired. So I had an injury in combat, as well as some, long-term overuse injuries, plus the, discovery of a long-term medical condition that all kind of built up to me getting a medical retirement. And, so the Navy deemed me no longer fit for duty, and I, you know, got out basically at the very end of 2009. And up to that point, you know, I had served at SEAL teams on both the West Coast and then the East Coast, and deployed numerous times. My first deployment was started 2 weeks before 9/11, And I was in the jungle area, and then we got shipped off to the desert because of, 9/11. And then I did a number of other, deployments, and, got married, had kids. Towards the end, the last 5 years of my career, I was gone anywhere from 250 to 280 days a year, whether either training or deployed. I didn't even put enough miles on my vehicle in 5 years to get an oil change. So when I went to look at my odometer in 5 years, I had put 2,000 miles on my car. So
that's why they put that sticker on there that says 3,000 miles or 90 days.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, that sounds extreme for a military person to be gone that long. Is that unique to the SEALs?
I think it was unique to the SEALs, or special ops in particular, at the time, and the it's called the op tempo or the operational tempo, and the deployment cycles and the needs of these, of what we were doing, the type of missions we were able to do. And, granted, they are shorter deployments than, an infantry guy at the time might be gone 18 months, and I might do a four to a nine month deployment, depending on the thing. But then when I was back, I was, we trained really hard too. We could be any sort of thing, a couple of weeks of parachute jumping and then a couple of weeks of this, that, or the other, just lots of travel, lots of training. And, it has come at a high cost, to the community, just special operations forces in general. So few people doing so much. They don't really know. They haven't really quantified that yet, right? But it's between all the different wars, and then all the travel, all the training, obviously the mental side of combat, that sort of thing.
So then you went into the life of leisure in a rocking chair after you were discharged, or right. Maybe not, huh? You went for some. You had to keep that competitive bug going. So I want to hear about the things you got into on the next step of life.
After I left the military, and I did those climbs, by the way, Brad, when I was in.
So oh, okay. Let's take the listener back to that.
Okay. So we had mentioned this on our, prior to starting, but I was kind of pigeonholed into becoming a lead climber. When I showed up at one of my new teams, I could do more pull-ups than the other new guy. So my team leader was like, okay, he's going to go do this job as a, collateral duty. And he looked at me and he said, I'd like you to be our lead climber. And I was like, okay. I didn't know anything about rock climbing or climbing in general. So I did it's similar to the theme we talked about, steep learning curves. I did 4 days of rock climbing out at Red Rocks in Las Vegas as my first trip. And the next time I did a rock climbing trip to Australia, I think it was called Mount Arapiles, or Arapilee. And so at this point I have 8 days of rock climbing under my belt. And, then the lead climber of the whole team was like, hey, we're taking a group and we're going to El Cap. And we're going to climb El Cap. And I was kind of nervous. I was like, what is that? It's like, I looked it up. It's this big wall. It takes days, right? So I got pigeonholed and went and climbed El Cap. And so the ninth time in my life of putting on a sit harness to actually climb rock was the first training day on El Cap. And, granted, we had a team of two or three and we had a guide. But we climbed all the pitches except two, which were really, really hard. And then that guide climbed those. But the rest of it, we climbed, and it took, We spent 2 days or two nights sleeping on the side of the mountain or the wall in those cots called portal ledges. And in the third night, we slept on the top because we had summited. So that was a trip. And we actually, the route we did was called the Tangerine Trip.
So you're relatively inexperienced, but you're a strong guy. You've conquered your fears in many ways. What were the main challenges of doing that? Was it physically difficult to climb for that long?
It was pretty physically difficult, just because we're used to walking and running around and stuff. And then now you're in a sit harness all day and it's a different, technique. But just the mental aspect of, even if you're like 1,000 foot up on a wall and we're climbing together and I just hand you a water bottle, I hand it to you this way and I wait for you to get two hands on it before I let go. Cause everything you do is epic when you're that high. Like every simple thing is, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. How do you do that? Like every movement you make is, can become catastrophic. So mentally, I mean, the adrenaline dump when you're done with that is like off the charts.
So everyone's pumped up watching Alex Honnold free solo that thing. I think you bumped into him during your trip there. But if you do make a mistake and you slip off, I guess you're going to fall a bit and then get jerked by the rope. What are the consequences and what kind of bummer is that?
Yeah, if you fall onto your rope, then you'll be held by the protection or the pieces you placed in the rock. So really the mental challenge is when you're putting your pieces in the rock, your little rock climbing pieces, your protection, just the mental aspect of placing it. And you're like, is that going to hold? And you're like, I hope so. And you move on to the next one. And you don't really find out until you fall. And you don't really want to. And just the night, like the first night I spent 600, 700 feet up off the deck, sleeping on a portal ledge, 3 or 4 foot away from the wall, because it was more than vertical. So my little portal ledge was not even touching the wall. It was just spinning in the wind.
You're just hanging out.
Yeah. It was definitely, one of the more scary things I did, for sure.
So it got you scared being up there, even though you can tell your brain say, hey, I'm safe, these things are steady. It's still a little bit unnerving for a Navy SEAL, huh?
For me it was, having not really, like at least when you're parachuting, you got tons of little ropes holding you on to a a canopy. But like rock climbing, you have one rope and it's holding your world, right? So little bit more. And I kept thinking about it, like I would think about it that way, and then I would just put it, I put everything aside. And rock climbing is really cool. It teaches you to only focus on the moment, because that's all you can do. Like you have to focus on this piece, this move, this piece, this, and that, you can't really worry about the ones you already placed or or the next pitch. You really stay present. And I think Alex talks about that in his, obviously he's in some crazy flow state climbing that thing without a rope. So,
yeah, the most amazing insight I got from the documentary Free Solo, and it had to come in my second viewing of it. I think I've seen it 4 times now. It's just, I call it the greatest athletic achievement of all time in the history of humanity, with no one near in second place. Usain Bolt was up there. Tiger Woods winning the U.S. Open by 15 strokes is up there, but that was just stunning. But I saw him in the middle with his little comp book writing about his moves. And yep, I realized then that he has memorized the whole bloody thing, so that, his first leg up on the mountain is his toes touching the protruding bump. And then he reaches over with his right hand and grabs on a little shelf, and he knows the entire route. And that was the real mind blower, that, he's memorized this to that extent.
And so, you know, the word free implies that he's just looking on this rock. Where is he going to go next? Like the guy in the climbing gym. But this was something altogether even more impressive that it was that, you know, deliberate and methodical.
You know, we don't, we always had an expression with our, so with our training, and obviously it was different, but it was combat style training. Like we believed that we didn't rise to the occasion. We fell to our level of preparation. And look at his level of preparation was beyond compare, right? He had memorized, he had scripted that entire thing. Not only had he done that, he had physically done every piece of it, right?
You know, with the ropes.
Yeah.
Right. So practicing, training.
No surprises for him, right? He, you know, and he did the work before that point, even to think about that accomplishment, right? He didn't just think, oh, I'm going to go, I can rock climb a little bit. I think I'm going to go try free soloing El Cap. The amount of work he did, we all look at the, you know, the video and what he did and like, oh, he must be a mutant. And he obviously is crazy, but he, you know, he definitely fell to his level of training. He did more work than you can't even capture the hours that he did in a, you know, whatever, a 90-minute documentary. That would be my guess.
Right. The guy that wants to be a SEAL on Tuesday morning as well as Friday night.
Right. Right.
Oh, it's been so fascinating talking about this journey. I do want to talk about your climbing the high peaks because that's a whole nother world. Yeah. So this was also while you were in the service. Yes. So tell us about those climbs. And was that part of training or was this sort of like when you had a 6-week leave, you're going to go climb one of the highest peaks in the world? What happened there?
So, yeah, I was, like I said, I was a, you know, lead climber in my little team. And we, you know, we're increasingly doing some high altitude stuff or mountaineering stuff in Afghanistan and things like that. And a friend of mine, who, you know, he ended up dying, but he had this vision, his name was Heath Robinson. He had this vision that after we did El Cap, he's like, well, that's enough of big wall climbing. Let's go do some mountains. And, his vision was to do, you know, the 7 summits. So we went and, we climbed, Denali, and then that was in 2008. And then we climbed Aconcagua in 2009, which are the highest peaks in North and South America. And we had an opportunity to work with some really awesome guides on those. We climbed Denali with Mark Twite, famous mountaineer and mountain guide, and with his group. And the guide in particular on Aconcagua was a guy named Rolo Garabudi. So we had these awesome guides. We had awesome guides on El Cap as well, obviously. But we got to do these climbs and do a whole different thing, this mountaineering thing. And, you know, it, for me, that was a lot more fun, even though probably mentally not as hard. At least the routes we took, they were not the super technical routes. They were more like grinded out, less technical, more endurance routes. But it was very cool experience.
Are you telling me you took the easy route up Denali? Is that what you're trying to say here?
I would, it technically is the easiest route up Denali, but it, you know, it's still, there were times where it's 30 below inside your tent, with no wind. So it's, you know, Denali is still hard.
I'm kind of seeing that as like a show title, you know, the easy route up Denali and other life challenges or something. Yeah. Yeah. How about that?
True. The easy, yeah. Right. Yeah. The easy, that is great.
Now were you a novice in high mountaineering when you set off on these trips too?
Yeah, that was, you know, I had no, you know,
you went to Pikes Peak in Denver, and put a flag up and then headed to Alaska.
No, I hadn't even done that. I hadn't done any mountaineering trips. You know, I'm a flatlander from Iowa who moved moved, you know, to the, you know, at that time I was living at sea level on the East Coast. But I will say for both of those trips, I was in exceptional shape, maybe not acclimated to the altitude, but you can acclimate to altitude. It didn't take too long, but I was in really good shape, just simply moving with load for hours and hours because of my, you know, walking around Iraq and Afghanistan with body armor. And, you know, I augmented that with, you know, kettlebell training in a way that, you know, I always prioritized power to weight ratio. So I wanted to get strong, but I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to make the engine any bigger, right? So I always was like making sure I was getting stronger and getting more fit without getting bigger. And it was in 2005, I had met Pavel, and kind of have kept in touch with him since. And I've
this is Pavel Satsalin, the kettlebell master of the planet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So I've used his systems to kind of prepare me for everything from deployments to mountaineering trips. And I will say that like lots of kettlebell swings and things like that did have, you know, it did feel a lot like I was walking uphill. Right. So, and I didn't get like kind of the, you know, didn't put on the bulk that I may have with doing pure barbell type training. So,
So this, did you personally seek out Pavel, or was this integrated into your, you know, your assignments, your missions, your team operations?
No, I had met him. He had come to our command in like 2005. And like before that, I saw a friend of mine doing some kettlebell swings and some snatches. And I was like, you know, the first time you see that, especially in the early 2000s, it was kind of absurd looking. And I was like, you know, you're going to hurt yourself. Stop doing that. And I met Pavel, and then I would, you know, I went through his training, and I started to use it to get ready for deployments. And I noticed, you know, before that I would have like it was kind of bodybuilder style lifting. You know, you have your leg day, and then you have your, you know, your back and your biceps day or whatever. And then you would separate it from your cardio. And, you know, it was kind of, it just took forever to work out. And now I could do, you know, with kettlebell swing, like the dynamic movements, I could combine my cardio and my strength in one move. And I just noticed after 6 months of doing that, when I went on deployment, I actually moved well with weight. And before that, I was more disjointed, perhaps because I was doing, you know, isolation bodybuilder style exercises and not augmenting it with the right cardio, or not doing it in a manner that got my heart rate going. So I just noticed when I was on, I think the first deployment after doing that training, I could all of a sudden not only move around well, but do so, you know, under load. So.
Yeah. Incredible. I mean, you know, functional training for what you're doing out there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, man. It's been a wild ride. And I'm curious now, today, you know, you've been through all these incredibly intense experiences, kind of like, an athlete playing in the major leagues. And then, you know, now you're settling into real life with your four kids in Omaha, Nebraska. I wonder what that transition's like and how you kind of feed that, you know, competitive intensity that obviously you honed for so many years.
Yeah, I, you know, sometimes I go speak to groups, and I've always said that the hardest, I mean, it's hard to become a Navy SEAL, and it's hard to keep that job once you get there because of the accountability. But
what does that mean? You mean,
you can get kicked out for mistakes.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. Like if you make a mistake in the shoot house, or if you make safety violations, if you have safety violations when you're handling demolition, or, you know, we're talking about dangerous things, jumping out of parachutes or jumping out of airplanes, throwing grenades, blowing stuff up, and shooting at people who are shooting you. So the tolerance for mistakes is very minimal. So when I say it's hard to get there and it's harder to stay, I mean it's harder to stay because they kick people out all the time for screwing up, and like they should. But the harder thing for me, that always came natural to me. The harder thing for me has been to get out. Just you would think it'd be so easy, like, oh, now I can sit on the couch, get a 9-to-5, and you know, I don't have to worry about getting blown up or shot at or jumping out of planes. But it's hard because, you know, you were a professional triathlete. I talked to a friend who was a professional climber. So much of, I think one of the hardest things is so much of how we build our identity is in what we do, right? So my identity was SEAL for so long, and then to just abruptly lose that, it was challenging. And then you can compound that with not having an ability to, you know, support your family, because I didn't have a college degree, all those sort of things. It's not like companies aren't just hiring SEALs unless they're hiring security experts and things like that. So transitioning, finding a job, and then another really hard aspect of it was losing that team environment. Mm. Right. So really what I've done is like, okay, now my identity is not my job. I have a job to support my family, and my new team is my family and my other coworkers. And that's kind of my new battle, if you will. And you know, you just got to find a way.
Right. You using those same skills and leveraging those in an entirely different direction. But it sounds like you've done a great job with that. I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about the heart-led leadership and what you're doing with Strong First.
So I was the CEO for Strong First for a while. About 3 years. I left that job, would have been in 2017. I still, you know, communicate with Pavel, and we're still close friends. And while I was there, I actually hired Dr. Craig Marker. So I've heard him on your podcast. Great guy. We still compare notes on fitness stuff. I went and ran after that. I ran some, some firearms training programs for a while. And now I just do a bunch of different things. I work, I work for the Center for Heart-Led Leadership, teaching, working with leaders on everything from leadership to team building and just building culture. I'm building a training program for a manufacturing company called Tritool. And I also do some work, with a CBD company, called Defy, and I'm just helping them. I've had great success with their product. So I'm helping getting that into the hands of more veterans, right?
Uh-huh.
Just kind of doing a little bit of everything, I suppose.
Love it. And the veterans in many ways have a rough time when they're done, seems like.
Yeah. For the reasons I mentioned, right? Like that kind of that identity and that loss of that team. And really, I mean, don't underestimate how hard it is. You might not make much money in the military, but also it doesn't really matter because you know what everyone makes. So an E5 makes what an E5 makes, and there's no keeping up with the Joneses. You're not fooling anybody. We all know what everyone makes. And that's, you know, then you get out, you live in a neighborhood or whatever, and you know, not all of the things you learn in the military specifically translate to the private sector, right? None of the companies that I've worked for hired me because I was a sniper, right? So that would be a specific skill transfer.
However, it is on your resume, so it probably came up in an interview. So tell me about your snipering, Eric, if that's the correct term.
Well, there is physics involved, so...
Well, I'm kind of feeling like the transfer from especially Navy SEAL, the most elite performer in a huge, gigantic organization and you know, coming through that strict and, you know, narrow funnel, It seems like that would translate directly to such that corporate America would be salivating to find you guys and headhunt you immediately and put you in a position, in a leadership position. I mean, are you kidding me? Going into a conference room with these bozos that are, you know, blowing smoke and doing their PowerPoint versus a guy who's been to war. Oh my gosh, I would bet on that guy 10 times over if it's, you know, for a competition for a hiring position or something. But you're making it sound like you don't have that gravy train set up, even as a Navy SEAL.
Well, I think, you know, there are some people that do. Most of us, myself included, don't have a college degree. So that's...
What? You went through Bud's training. Oh my gosh. You should have seen my roommates in college. They were the most degenerate humans. They could barely get their mouth off the bong that was at the door exiting the apartment to go sit in the back of class. And then, oh my goodness. Anyway.
Well, I think, you know, corporate America has not, you know, caught up with that fact yet. You know, I think most of them still look at a college degree as a prerequisite. But if you look at like my experiences or the experiences of my teammates or those who were in special operations or just military in general, like what you learn, like as a leader, as not just a leader, but how to be a good teammate, how to execute and get things done, and be positive member in a team and build the culture and that sort of stuff, you know, and combine that with, you know, especially in the case of the SEALs or any of these special ops that have such rigorous selection. If I know what I need to do, and how to do it, like I'm just purely not going to quit. And if you just point me in a direction and give me a right and left, like, here's my rules and here's what you need me to go do, then, you know, myself and other people like me who have similar, they're just not going to quit. It's going to happen, right? They're going to make it happen.
Eric, I think we just figured out your next entrepreneurial project here, because we have on one side this talent pool of people that aren't going to quit and they're going to make it happen. And on the other side, we have people pulling their hair out right now today because they can't get their staff to get off a log and get something done. And oh my gosh, the Navy SEAL headhunter corporate organization is ready for action. Listeners, if you want to hire a Navy SEAL, send a note to the show. We will tee you up with people that are going to rock your world. Oh my goodness.
I love it. It's a great idea.
Hey man, thanks so much for spending the time. That was a fascinating conversation. I feel like we learned so much about, you know, what it's like in that, you know, elite world and coming from, you know, the small town in Iowa to the top of the mountain in North America, South America. Amazing stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Where can we connect with you? Where do you want to send the listeners?
I guess I don't really have much to sell here.
Oh, Navy SEALs aren't banging up social media. Oh, excuse me. He's not sending out selfies every day.
I mean, I do have social media.
Let's
can follow me there. Just Eric Frohart on
Doing the, what were you doing? The push-ups in the snowstorm there? That's a great, I love that Instagram site. Come on, go follow him, people. Eric Frohart.
Yeah, Eric Frohart on Instagram and once in a while, Facebook. I'm not really, you know, too active. So
awesome. All right. Well, keep it up. Keep up doing the real thing. And good luck in your new home.
Awesome. Thanks, Brad.
Eric Frohart, people. Thank you very much. Da, 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 da. It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece. Hey, this is going to be one of my favorite commercials because I get to introduce you to the delicious, nutritious, life-changing Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece. This is a mind-blowing nut butter blend that will soon ascend to your number one go-to snack, treat, or accoutrement for anything from dark chocolate, a cucumber celery smear, or mixed in with yogurt, oatmeal, cheesecake, or with a spoon right into your mouth, heading south. Let me tell you what I created in my kitchen through whirlwind experimentation and
and extreme sampling to my VIP product testing crew across the nation so far with 100% approval. In this beautiful jar, we have macadamia nuts, walnuts, cashews, the rare and precious coconut butter, coconut flakes, cacao nibs, real ancient sea salt, and organic MCT oil. Every single ingredient has been sourced to origin to be the very best we could find from around the world for the absolute highest purity and nutritional value. We run this product in small batches with a boutique family business in the Pacific Northwest, and everything is cold pressed to preserve nutritional value. So if you like eating healthy, it's a dream come true for all those who are keto, primal, paleo, and vegan, vegetarian too. I come in peace, my global healthy living friends. Masterpiece, that is. Try some now and it will change your life. I promise. If you don't like it, send it back to me. I'll eat it. You can order Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece on Amazon. Simple, simple. Or if you're bold, daring, and adventurous, buy three and get a bottle free at bradventures.com. Buy six and we'll send you 8. Christmas shopping early instead of late at bradventures.com. Check it out, Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece. Thank you for listening to the show. We would love your feedback at getoveryourselfpodcast@gmail.com. And we would also love if you could leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a hassle. You have to go to desktop iTunes, click on the tab that says ratings and reviews, and then click to rate the show anywhere from 5 to 5 stars. And it really helps spread the word so more people can find the show and get over themselves because they need to. Thanks for doing it.